Hey everybody, it's Norm from Tested here, and this week's episode of This Is Only a Test was brought to you by Casper Mattresses. They're obsessively engineered, American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/test and using the offer code TEST. That's T-E-S-T. I know a bunch of you have done it. Thank you so much. Listen, you spent about a third of your life sleeping. Let's make sure you do it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies together for better nights and brighter days. Latex foam and memory foam. It's science. They've got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. And they've also got a risk-free trial policy and return policy. The mattress gets delivered straight to you. You can try it for 100 days, risk-free. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. At the store, you get maybe a minute to try the mattresses. With Casper, you actually get to sleep on it. Don't go to the store and sleep on their mattresses. They'll probably kick you out. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, it's a pretty great price point. So again, get $50 toward any mattress purchase and support our podcast by going to casper.com/test and using the offer code TEST. Terms and conditions may apply, but right now let's start the show for Thursday, January 21st, 2016. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of This Is Only a Test. I'm your host, Norm, and joined this week to my left, Kishore Hari, senior science correspondent of Tested.
Hello.
And to his left, senior podcaster.
Whatever.
We're going to find a title for you. Jeremy Williams.
Hi.
You know, I think I'm on autopilot. The past 3 minutes, my brain did not have the part of my brain, Kishore, what is the part of your brain that monitors your conscious thought?
Oh, I have no idea.
Is it the prefrontal lobe?
Prefrontal cortex is what you associate with sort of our very conscious thought. And then but there's different networks that run through all these different areas of the brain.
So the prefrontal lobe of my brain.
Cortex.
Prefrontal cortex was just muted for the past 3 minutes. I knew once the podcast started I needed to roll on, and then it was all amygdala. It was all fight or flight.
All amygdala.
and I chose fight.
You were in the zone.
But welcome, everyone. I'm very, very tired, very sleepy. It's been a very long week of exciting things that unfortunately we can't talk about. Well, you know what? It's Thursday, isn't it?
Yep.
Oh, wait, this podcast. Okay. So I guess people listening to the podcast will get a preview. And this is why you listen to This Is Only a Test, because you guys are going to get a preview of a video. Hopefully, I'm making promises that I'm committing Joey to at this point.
Joey, producer, better edit that thing together today.
Later this morning, you're going to want to go to our YouTube channel or tested.com and watch a video of us. That's me, Frank Ippolito, and Adam Savage inspecting the Martian spacesuit.
Wait. How'd you get a Martian spaceship?
Well, Bring Home the Martian, nominated for 7 Academy Awards, available now on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital HD.
Is it already out?
It's already out.
How about that?
How about that? Now you know. And sharing that knowledge is how we got access to the suit. So a little behind the scenes, we've been working on this for quite a while. Adam's social media manager and our social media manager, Kristen Lamazzi, has been in touch with 20th Century Fox Home Video and to help spread the word about the movie's Blu-ray release and its recent critical acclaim and awards. We asked and they granted us access to I think one of their only spacesuits. Now I was at CES was 2 weeks ago, I believe, and I saw a Martian spacesuit at CES at the GoPro booth.
Oh, that makes sense.
It makes sense because GoPro, I think, had a big collaboration with the production. I don't know what money exchanged hands or what happened, but those cameras that you see on the spacesuits, clearly GoPro, you know, circa 2050.
Hey, GoPros work in 1/6 atmosphere. That's what you know.
Yeah, and on three-axis gimbals. And the, sometimes in one of those shots actually drooped and did not work. But anyway, it was they had a Mark Watney suit at the show. And it was very exciting to see that there. I took some pictures. And it turns out, I think that is that suit is the only suit at the costume department at Fox still
in existence?
In existence or accessible by the public.
Ridley has a reputation for destroying a lot of his props.
What?
After the
so
movie.
They must have had like 8 suits or something like that.
I bet there were... I mean, certainly, in total, multiple suits. I mean, there are shots where you have the cast, multiple members of the cast, when they're escaping the dust storm in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
It's multiple suits are all worn on. They all have them on. And then most of the rest of the movie is Mark Watney in his suit. Some of those are hero suits for close-ups when they have shots when he's looking at his arm or up close. Some of those are stunt suits, like when, spoilers, when disaster happens. Mm. He gets knocked around. But... I think that it's not like the FBFX, the production company, the effects studio that made the suits, made like X number of individual suits. They did have, you know, a hodgepodge of parts. It's like they took pieces from some and put it the other. Like, you know, they're done shooting the scene with Johansson and Beck with their suits. Then they're going to use those pieces in the stunt armor suits for Watney, but make sure the helmet and the suits is Watney, right? So
the suit you had yesterday was Watney suit?
It was a Watney suit. I can't say too much more because we have a lot more planned with it. And the video going up today is kind of our first look, first impressions, and some basic analysis of the suit. But we did have access to it. And it's part of Adam's ongoing process of documenting, creating reference, or taking reference and creating a lot of cataloging and photos and all sorts of stuff to recreate his own suit.
Cool.
How did it look compared to some of the replicas we saw in movie theaters when the movie came out?
Yeah, a really interesting thing. I don't know if Adam has shared this yet. I want to say he has on Still Entitled, but he was able to buy on eBay the helmets for one of the suits.
From The Martian?
From the movie theater displays.
Oh, gotcha.
So... whatever promotion company that Fox worked with to build those stands, they also put suits or at least helmets in studios.
I didn't see any of these.
And
yeah, we're both looking on eBay right now to see.
I don't know.
And
exactly.
Only Marvin the Martian things are coming up.
I don't know how much it costs. I don't know who sold them on eBay, but I believe, the helmet that Adam had when he got off eBay didn't look super impressive, and this one did in person.
Yeah.
It needs to be fit for screen. That being said, there are a lot of things that really make it look like up close, clearly a prop. You know, it's not a piece of space equipment. But, you know, you can see the decals, you can see where the seams are, you know, a lot of things are held together with magnets. But anyway, I don't want to spoil too much, but that is just a little bit of a preview of something that's going to hopefully... Again, committing Joey to this video edit today. go up Thursday, later this morning. We're recording this podcast on Wednesday, which is why I say later today. And also, it's why I'm super tired because I flew back up back late last night from this trip. And then we're also doing some fun stuff later today with Kishore. But Kishore, this is the first episode of the new year that you've been on the podcast. How were your holidays?
It was awesome. I went back home to visit my folks.
Which is where?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it was like 70 degrees back east over the holidays. You went back east too, right?
No, we stayed here.
You stayed here.
Yeah.
But it was so exceedingly warm, but I have a lot of nephews and nieces, and my son are all pretty close to the same age, so we played like football in the backyard and built a ton of Lego,
cool.
Which is basically, that sounds like a awesome holiday to me.
Yeah, which kits did you build? Which sets? You know, some people get pissed off when I say kits, and I will continue to say Lego kits, but the official nomenclature is sets. They are set. So which sets did you build?
We built a bunch of little ones because we had the kids involved. So we built the current iteration of the Millennium Falcon, which is the largest one we did. And then we did a couple of TIE fighters. I haven't seen Star Wars Rebels yet, but all of these kids had, and they were all about the Inquisitor and his TIE fighter.
I've only seen
these
one.
Are all words I don't
understand. Yeah, I don't get them either. I've watched a part of a season and I like it more than Clone Wars. I just can't bring myself to watch the whole thing. It's a commitment.
Yeah, I'm not there yet. So we built a lot of Star Wars Lego, like way too much Star Wars Lego. And then there was a whole slew of...
Are other adults doing this with you and the kids, or is it just... That's cool.
Parents involved, but it's really about the at least for my son, he's five. He loves Lego at this age because he likes being able to follow instructions and like complete project. And there's a little bit of like resilience and like, you know, building and failing and going back and repeating. So the kits or whatever you want to call them are really great for him.
They're sets. My son, who is now eight, has always built Lego according to the instructions, and then he's done. And I've always encouraged him to be inventive and think outside the box. And
remix.
When we saw the Lego movie afterwards, he acutely pointed out that the roles were flipped compared to our life, where he, the kid, wanted to follow the instructions, and the dad, you know, wanted to remix.
The villain. Will Ferrell.
Exactly.
I totally believe in the remix. My son doesn't want to do it yet either.
Yeah.
My mom sent me back with my original Legos that I had when I was a kid. We stored them in a talking ViewMaster tub.
You've stored them long enough, Kishore.
Yeah. So I have my old Legos and I keep them separate from his because I was like, these are my Legos. Those are your Legos. They don't build them the same anymore.
What do you mean? They do.
I think they do build them exactly the same, but...
I'm not going to crack down on Lego versus Legos.
Oh, my goodness.
No.
It's all good. But glad you had a good holiday. But did you follow any tech news? Did you follow CES at all?
I did follow CES. I watched a lot of the tested videos. I was mostly... I mean, I think the biggest thing I was following out of CES was not at CES. It was the Oculus launch because I pre-ordered.
Yeah, did you?
You weren't alone.
Yeah. Yeah. So you built your PC.
I built my gaming PC specifically in advance for what was coming down the pipe, Q1, or in my case, May. I think that's my shift date.
So you got it real late.
Oh, no. I ordered it like 8 after the hour that morning.
No way.
Yeah.
And you're still May?
I think it's in May. I'm pretty sure.
That's unfortunate.
I think it's because the Kickstarter ones are in line ahead of us. So
yeah, but there's a whole month between March 28th and May.
When are you?
I am April. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
We'll see. I think all of that is subject to change. So
were you shocked by the price like some other people were?
I was only marginally shocked by the price. I was expecting like $499 because that sounded like a good number to me. And so it was $100 more than I expected. But I didn't mind the price for what I consider it to be, which is this is like an early adopter, first generation. And
very high tech, very high tech.
Yeah, and I just bought a phone over Christmas that was like, you know, in that price range. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel like it's out of line with other technology products. And I think the price will come down in further iterations. I think the hard part isn't about the Oculus price. It's about the PC price for most people.
Yeah.
That's really the barrier. I don't think anyone's complaining about the video card pricing, which is like $400 for the video card you need to run this. But I think there are similar complaints that you can file.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people who used to be PC gamers who are coming back into the fold now, having to eat that large cost of being a PC gamer.
Yeah, well, and it's how much the price of a high-end secondary monitor would be. You know, if you're looking, and you can think of that as it is a display that you're using. You know, instead of buying a secondary monitor, you can buy the Rift, which you can use a lot of those same functions you would a secondary monitor.
I think everyone who buys the Rift 5 seconds after they put it on, they're going to forget all about that $600.
And you haven't even put on the consumer version.
I haven't.
You're just using that DG2.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that
later.
We
will. I know. There's a whole VR Minute. We're not going to jump that right now. Last week, we did a full VR Minute episode. But we do have Kishore here, and we will have later this episode a Science Minute. It's not been a big tech week. Kishore and Jeremy, I don't think I asked you guys last week, do you guys watch any new movies or TV shows over your break, over the holiday break?
Yeah, I finished Jessica Jones.
Okay.
And I liked it. I actually really liked it. I will never watch that show again. It was too difficult to watch. I finished Master of None. I started Making a Murderer. I watched a ton of movies.
Sounds like a lot of those shows, Netflix shows that you're watching.
No, I also watched Man in the High Castle. So I did watch a lot of streaming shows because there isn't a lot of network stuff on, new network stuff on. I'm really excited about Legends of Tomorrow on CW, which premieres tonight. Though I hear it's a little bit of a hot mess. I like the DC TV
show universe.
Yeah, I think The Flash is the best superhero TV show on right now.
Oh.
And it's way better than Gotham, which is broody as hell, and Arrow, which I feel like is written for tweens. And I just really enjoy that show tremendously. So I've been keeping up with a lot of shows, but it's been stream month for me. How about you?
Most recently, I had to pirate an episode of Downton Abbey for my wife. Who
stealing from PBS? It's for shame.
You've really hit a new low when you've stolen from PBS. I understand that. I am a contributor. I don't think that balances it out. But so we were at a hotel where she couldn't watch PBS. That was an ordeal. But I was a hero for a moment. And the only other thing I've been watching is Game of Thrones, finally, because they made a pinball machine based on the show, which means I won't understand it. And so I'm through episode season two, and I'm still enjoying it.
You're binging that.
There's so much to watch, but yeah, it's...
Is there a bumper that just says, Hodor?
Yeah.
Hodor.
There is a mode. There is a secret wizard mode, I think, that does that, secret multiball.
Of course it does.
I mean, Game of Thrones is a show that... Like a ton of people watch it. It is by far the most pirated show, I think, that has ever existed in television history. But it's a show that is really great to watch with someone who has read the books. The composition of your viewing party, if it has a balance of people who've read the books and people who haven't,
oh, yeah?
That's the best.
That's interesting. I understand with season three, that's the first season where they start breaking up the books. Like the first two seasons are based on books.
Yeah, and I think season three, they split one of the books in two, and then now they're doing jumping forward, and at some point, George R.R. Martin...
They're going to pass the books
they
now.
They will. Yeah, he wrote
this season in 30 days. They're about to go past the books.
Yeah, because he missed his deadlines. He thought he could finish the second to last book. So he has two books yet to release, I believe, in Song of Ice and Fire, and he apologized that he wouldn't make it.
It was going to be a trilogy of books, and then they decided to expand it to six? Seven?
Seven, I think.
Why? Because of the success? Do you know? Anyone?
I don't know.
All right, just curious.
Because the story demanded it.
I suppose that's the... the company line.
No, and that's the way he writes too, I believe, and the way the show is written. Like characters, it's, you know, even though it's a fantasy world and there are dragons and magic and undead, consequences happen, and these characters feel real because, you know, they make good decisions, some make bad decisions, and those decisions have consequences.
All right.
So no one gets a last minute save because people like the character, you know. So everything's, it's like a chain reaction of human.
I'll accept that.
Yeah. Anyway, I did want to bring up streaming shows and Netflix, because Netflix is a huge point of controversy for broadcast executives. And broadcasts, they're fighting streaming services. A lot of the attention span of viewers are going over to Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and those exclusive shows. But they're also pissed off that Netflix doesn't release their subscriber number or their viewer numbers. They have released subscriber numbers, but they don't release the viewing data, which is traditionally how a cable show or a broadcast show generates money, ad revenue.
Yeah. Why should they? They don't have advertisers.
Exactly. They don't. But it's all about that timeshare. And I think Netflix does, through analytics, that you can see how much people are watching Netflix over at certain periods of time, like with bandwidth consumption. And they're doing that instead of doing... But the broadcast executives, want that comparison. They want to say, you know, you're saying that Jessica Jones or Daredevil has been this breakout success, but how does it compare to NCIS? You know, how does it compare to Big Bang Theory? And they would use that. I mean, they could use that information to sell higher ads for their shows or to... You know, as a last grasp in fighting against subscriber streaming only services.
Now, I see no reason for Netflix to give out those numbers.
They don't need to. They absolutely don't need to. They can have it both ways. So I think, who was this executive? I think, was it an NBC executive?
It was an NBC one, and it was some private company that did the analysis.
Yeah, they made the announcement that they finally broke the code, that they figured out how many people were watching Netflix shows. And they claim that, you know, Master of None, for example, 3.9 million viewers, Narcos to 3.2 million viewers, and The Man in the High Castle, Amazon's big breakout success, 2.1 million viewers. I don't know exactly, within the first 35 days of its premiere. So it's not like over one night. Again, these metrics, they're apples, literally yeah. apples and oranges. It's not appointment television. It's over time. You know, even if you take into DVR, it's not exactly the same. Nielsen ratings can't compare these. You can't compare them to these different metrics. But it wasn't even NBC who did the analysis. They pulled the data from a company called Symphony Advanced Media. And it's really interesting how this company claims to get the viewership data.
Yeah.
Because yep. you can't tap in the streams. You can't say, you know, I'm going to tap in the Comcast's pipe and say, oh, how many of these streams are Master of None streams? That's not how it works. It's an opt-in app that you download, and I say opt-in because you can't find it in the app store. You have to sign up for it and get a certificate, developer certificate or beta certificate, and get it directly sideloaded essentially onto your phone. It taps into your microphone and it listens, and you leave it on.
This seems ridiculous. There's no way I'm installing that app.
Who would install that app?
Well, apparently enough people that they can generate, they can extrapolate viewership data.
It's like the Nielsen ratings. They put a box on your TV that
and the Nielsen ratings is a intermediate device between your cable box and your television.
Yeah.
So it can tap into the cable streams and parse that Comcast data, Comcast and whatever broadcast networks. They want you to figure that out. Netflix, the digital stream is agnostic, can't do that. So it literally takes microphone data from the room and runs it through audio analysis, much like Shazam does
yeah.
for songs. And because they index Master of None, Jessica Jones, all the Netflix shows and Amazon shows, they can then extrapolate not only how many households are watching it, but then also, I guess, with the other microphone data, how many people are watching it at the same time. Now, why would someone do it? Because if you opt in, I think you get like a $5 gift certificate a month.
That's awesome.
Unfortunately, it's probably picking up all this false data from me doing my Aziz Ansari impression around the
That's
house.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see what the statistical data actually looks like, because I don't think they publicly released their analysis.
No, they didn't. They just released their extrapolations.
And Netflix quickly called it crap. So it's hard to position what it is. To me, I actually found it really satisfying. I've kind of wondered personally how many people are watching these shows as well. And that's sort of on par. I know you can't compare them, but that's on par with just like network TV kind of shows. And it's sort of gratifying that there's that many people watching those Netflix shows. It reinforces that the quality is winning out somehow.
Well, Netflix, I mean, we talk about it a lot because it's a big deal in the United States, but it is not necessarily a big deal outside of the United States yet. Canada is getting a more robust Netflix offering. China is a place that Netflix is slowly moving into, but not in a big rush. They've said in the past that at CES, they'll move in when there are the set-top boxes, when Apple's figured out how to sell Apple TVs and streaming services in China. They'll piggyback on that. But a lot of people outside the U.S. use VPNs to route around and get content and access to shows. A lot of it's also like your Downton Abbey analogy, where you had the power of Downton Abbey because it wasn't available in the US yet. Like things like Sherlock, it sometimes get, and
well,
Black
it is,
Mirror.
It is.
No. Oh, it is. Yeah. You just had to get
it wasn't in the hotel.
Ah, no. Okay. So, but there are sometimes different release dates and schedules globally for shows. But time waits, for no pirater. And so people use VPNs, and Netflix said that it will step up enforcement against subscribers who use proxies.
They actually started the VPN blocking. I mean, it's a little bit of a losing battle because all you have to do is change the IP and then it doesn't work.
Yep.
But they're really doing this to as a start to curb that behavior. And there's a lot of people in the U.S. that will buy VPN services abroad for illegal file sharing or to break around the sort of region barrier here.
What's the incentive for Netflix to block it? I mean, you would think as long as they're getting the revenue for the account.
I imagine it's because of their partnership deals with certain content providers.
Right.
Say, like, we only want people from this region to be able to watch this content. And right. So they're trying to be good faith inside of that.
They have to balance their relationship with the content providers with their relationship with the customers.
Yeah, exactly. And then maybe this isn't true. I wonder if it mucks up their analytics when things go through VPNs.
I suppose. But if they can block them, they know which IPs to blacklist from the analytics too.
The international market's huge for them too. They added 6 million subscribers in just the last towards the end of the year in international markets. So like their shares have like jumped over the past couple days because of that. So
price hikes on the way too, I think.
I'm sure a price hike is coming down.
They've announced the streaming only plans going up to $10.
Yeah, I'm sure further price hikes are coming too.
Yeah.
Let's pivot a little bit. Microsoft announced just today that they are recalling Surface Pro power cords for the Surface
that
Pro.
That power cord?
Not this one, because not for the new Surface Pro 4 or the Surface Book, but it is for the Surface Pro, Pro 2, and Pro 3, anything purchased before March 2015 due to possible overheating issues. We've been advocates of the Surface Pro 3 I love that laptop, last year, 2 years ago now, I guess. And I hadn't experienced personally any overheating problems. But if you do have a Surface Pro 3 and you got it before March 2015, they will exchange it and get you a new one. Microsoft has... It's interesting. I think they were ambitious with the Surface line and successful, and those were very well received. I obviously like them. I like the Surface Book, but they didn't stick the landing for a lot of this stuff. Even with the Surface Book, there are still some bugs with their latching mechanism, with the keyboard responding every time it detach and relatch. And if you go to the support forums, there are a lot of disappointed customers out there. Microsoft did come out and publicly apologize and say they were working on driver updates and firmware updates to polish everything, but it's not perfect yet. And that kind of fit and finish is what we don't see a lot of on the Apple side. It's one of the reasons when you buy a MacBook, you know, there are some things in the OS you can't do that you can do on the PC side, and some applications you can't run. But overall, that fit and finish and the software experience is going to be polished. And outside of the download certificates crashing or my soundboard crashing, you know, mid-podcast.
I had to replace the power cable to GameFrame in Australia. Somebody wrote me and said, actually, you send us all Chinese power cables. I don't know if you know that, but they look the same.
But they're different.
But they don't have insulation in China.
Oh.
They do have insulation on the metal prongs in Australia.
Oh, wow.
They're very serious about that. So I had to send all new power cables.
Hey, this is interesting. Also related to media, Univision?
Univision is one of the highest rated television networks in the U.S. It's the Spanish language channel here.
Yes.
And they're making a huge move towards a younger audience like most TV networks right now. And they've owned a minority share in The Onion for a long time.
What?
It is a bizarre relationship. And just a couple days ago, they bought a majority share in The Onion and its properties, which includes the AV Club and Clickhole.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know they owned Clickhole, but that's
yeah.
funny.
Well,
that's
also funny. They have the parody for like Vice, and they also have the parody for the gossip blogs.
Oh, nice.
I forget their names. I'm going to dig that up in just a second.
Are these all privately held shares, or is The Onion public and I didn't even know it?
I don't think The Onion is public, okay. But it's a really interesting move because I think networks are trying to find a way to reach younger audiences.
Yeah.
And, some people are projecting that's what this is about. I don't know what that looks like, but I think it's very forward thinking.
Well, a lot of people also don't know that Univision also owns Fusion.
Oh yeah.
And if you pair those things together and don't think of Univision as just the Spanish TV network, you know, Fusion is right up there with The Onion in terms of being relevant and reporting news and telling stories, interesting stories in a cool way on the web. So really interesting. Huh. I love Clickhole. Do you really? I think it's hilarious.
Huh. I don't know. I'm a huge fan of The Onion. At least I used to be when I read it often. They retweet Clickhole quite often on Twitter. That's okay.
I mean, it's a bit of a downer, but the thing I admire most about The Onion is every time there's a mass shooting, they put up that same article every time. Mm-hmm. I think The Onion, for as ridiculous it is, actually has a finger on the pulse of what's going on as well. And their satire is just spot on sometimes. Yeah. I don't follow Clickhole, but AV Club has some really great stuff when it comes to television reviews and interviews. So
They're a serious journal.
Oh, yeah.
I also love AV Club for how comprehensive they are in reviewing TV shows. And, you know, going back to not appointment television, I watch a lot of shows that aired maybe 4 or 5 years ago and what for the first time, or maybe 3 years ago, Fargo, Boardwalk Empire. And one of the pitfalls of watching shows not as a broadcast or as a release is you lose a lot of that, the water cooler talk, especially online. And one of the things I've always wanted is an archive of like Twitter. What was the Twitter stream like in my Twitter network, at least, the night that this episode was released? Even though I didn't watch it that night, I would like to at least revisit and have the archive and follow the stream. You know, get that second screen experience in the past, webarchive.org style. But you can't do that. And maybe Twitter will offer that as a service in the future. I think it's culturally interesting. I want to see like what my friend said.
Would you want to have it revealed over the real time that it took to
exactly
for it to happen? So it could sync up if you wanted to rewatch an episode.
Yeah, or I mean, I guess I don't use Twitter that way either. I watch the show and then go on Twitter and look at the past hour.
Yeah, because there's too much chance for spoilers.
Yes,
and that kind of behavior.
So maybe just for that day.
Yeah.
Right. Like the moment in time, what was the conversation like online when the show aired? And you don't get that, but you can Google, you know, the AV Club review of a show and see the comments thread, which is a snapshot in time and the reviewer's point of view at that time, and that gives you a chance to relive with a viewing experience. And I like doing that, even watching old shows. So, The Onion's parody of TMZ is called Star Wipe.
What? I haven't visited Star Wipe. I'm going to make that happen.
And The Onion's version of Vice is called Edge. And they've done a few funny videos.
top headline on Star Wipe. How many Kardashians can you name before you grow weary of life? I think two. Two is my answer.
A big news in technology, actually, it was in aerospace technology this week. SpaceX attempted to land, and they already successfully landed a Falcon rocket.
Jeremy's watching it live for the first time right now. We'll watch his reaction.
No, I just watched it. It's a little distressing.
Well, so SpaceX had landed Falcon rocket on a stationary platform on
a concrete pad, which is how Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin also landed their rocket.
But the Blue Origin didn't go into space and deploy satellites.
No, not at all.
So the SpaceX achievement, much cool. And there's actually a really cool video that SpaceX put out showing their mission control and their employees and the tension leading up to that. It's awesome. But this past week they attempted, I mean, they're doing these like every other week now. It's crazy like how fast they're iterating and how many of these they already have queued up. But they tried a drone ship landing. Now, it sounds, I think, a little sexier than it actually is.
It's a barge that's a little bit out into the ocean, and it has a big target on it. They've tried to do this before. We've covered it on the podcast before. And unfortunately, there was some, according to Elon Musk, and he released this video at like 11 o'clock at night, which reinforces why you should follow Elon Musk on social media, especially for like late night tweets. As it landed, it has these like four prong landing mechanisms. And one of them they think had some condensation buildup when it launched and build up some ice on it when it re-entered. And so the things that it was supposed to grab onto couldn't because of ice buildup.
Huh.
And so it tipped over because one of the legs didn't get supported. And when a rocket tips over, it goes boom. Hits the ground. So it blew up on the barge pretty spectacularly. If you haven't seen the video, it's a really good watch. The video you're talking about, Norm, of the entire launch thing, I went to a talk last week here in San Francisco by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he was talking about space, and he played that entire SpaceX clip, and it's like 5-6 minutes long in front of a crowd of like 3,000 people, because he was saying, interesting, like the excitement they showed about landing a rocket back on the ground is the excitement his generation had about somebody walking on the moon.
Yeah.
And how much of a disconnect that is.
And it was young people.
Yeah. And
there were all really lots of bearded people. Hipsters there.
There was a lot of bearded hipsters there.
So the reason SpaceX wants to land is to reuse the rocket and save a ton of money, right?
Yeah.
But so this explosion was a costly event. Is this on par with what it would have cost traditionally to simply even put a rocket into space?
Well, so normally what happens is that rocket lands in the ocean and it's toast. So to them, this is only a little bit more money because you put in like some of the mechanisms to try to re-land it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth it in the long run. So basically, there was a Reddit AMA that was great that tried to estimate the cost of basically filling the tank. And it's about $400,000 to fill just with fuel in one of these rockets, but it costs millions of dollars to make the rocket itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a real, like orders of magnitude difference in terms of economics here.
Once they can do it. Yeah.
So in 2016 is the year we're going to see a rocket actually be reused because they successfully landed one in December. So we know that one's going to be reused.
Well, that one, they're not reusing.
Yeah, you're right. That one, they're not reusing. They're that one's that. Going into like the museum. You're right. But I think 2016 is the year that we are going to see a rocket reused. So all of these failures, even though they cost money, are worth it because the economic model in the long run is so advantageous.
I get that. But I was just curious if this loss is approximately what they would have lost anyway traditionally, just even sending any rocket up into space.
I think they built
a little bit more.
A little more because they're building in the trying to land.
Because they had to do the barge and they had to put in like the sort of reverse rocket thrust on a rocket that you normally wouldn't put in there.
But that's all cost in their accounting as part of their test, R&D. It's all R&D costs, right? It's not like this was, you know, they were going to send something up and then bring it down to the space station or something.
It's spectacular that we get to watch this in real time. So like if NASA was doing this, I don't think we'd get this kind of peek in the way that we've gotten with this, where basically this landing happened, I think at in the afternoon local time. And we saw it by that night. We saw like the GoPro type footage directly from the barge a couple hours later, which is unbelievable. It's so great how open they are about sharing this data and the excitement that it's generating.
Well, speaking of other non-barge drones, but corporate drones nonetheless, Amazon gave a little more detail about its Prime Air service. Now, Prime Air is their drone delivery service with that they both have multi-rotors, and also they announced VTOLs, vertical takeoff landings, over the holidays, a drone that can lift vertically and then also then fly long distances.
Like an airplane.
And with an interview in an interview with Yahoo News, Amazon gave a little bit more information about the kind of target specs they're going for with the drone delivery service. They say they're targeting creating delivery mechanisms that can fly for deliver a package within 30 minutes. So that's still within a range of like if you get a package ready, then you have a 20 minute flight time. It's about a 30 minute delivery time. And also they want the range has to be over 10 miles. The drones themselves are not going to be massive. They're going to be about 55 pounds, which I guess is right at the edge of that FAA registration. I don't know why that aligns with it because it's not the same categorization at all. And also they're talking about delivering parcels of up to 5 pounds, and 5 pounds doesn't sound like a lot. I know that was it Jeffrey? No, no, Larry David. Jeffrey. No, I'm sorry.
Jeremy Clarkson. I want it to be Larry David.
It was Jeremy Clarkson who, in the promo video, talked about getting a pair of sneakers, a pair of kicks, yeah, with Amazon Prime Air and shoes. Yeah, 5 pounds. Throws out the vast majority of things Amazon sells on a day-to-day basis. Under 5 pounds, the kind of things that people want in 30 minutes or less, mm-hmm, and the things that they've used their Prime Now service to study, under 5 pounds. So that works. And but this is all like, you know, this is all the kind of their target speculation and R&D stuff. But what's more interesting is how they're proposing working with the FAA instead of just granting blanket exemption on their service to use drones commercially. They're proposing a layer of airspace that would be,
oh, interesting,
for drone, wow, flight.
An altitude range.
Exactly. Because right now, above a certain feet, FAA controls all of that airspace, and it's all under the same rules, which makes sense when you're close to airports or parts of the, you know, there it's airspace where helicopters have to fly low specifically, and that kind of overlaps with what drones, with drone pilots typically fly in for recreation. But what they're proposing, maybe, for example, you know, manned aircraft above 500 feet, and then between 400 and 500 feet, which that type of precision you can get with drones, could be a safety buffer. And of course, outside the radius of airports. And
are they going to have to get buy-in from all of the kind of like helicopter pilots that have had free reign in that territory for a long time?
This would require serious legislation. But it's not completely unreasonable. I'm sorry, between 400 and 500 feet would be a no-fly buffer zone. And then between 200 and 400 feet would be what they're proposing.
Which is really low.
I know. 200 and 400 feet is really low.
That's drone territory. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, RC drone territory.
Yeah. And that's what they're proposing, commercial and RC drone. Mm. I mean, and you think about, like, everyone says, you know, the drones are coming, and we can only imagine what things are going to be like in the 5 to 10 years that scientists always say and technologists always say is going to be the quote-unquote future. But if we want to get to that point where, you know, seeing quadcopters and multirotors in the sky is normal, is everyday business, and that, I mean, maybe we don't want to get there, but from a technology standpoint, you know, if we're moving that direction where we can step outside and we're going to see just in our field of view, you know, dozens of quads, autonomous vehicles going about their business, making deliveries, and an air traffic infrastructure, a low altitude air traffic infrastructure, you're going to need the legislation. It's going to need to be something like this and not just the what we have right now, 500 feet and above.
I'm still really skeptical. I said this before on the podcast. I just think the drone delivery area, because of battery power, is not going to be any better than a driving radius. So I think it's not going to end up, from a consumer perspective, saving me much time from what they can do using traditional.
But it makes business sense, I think.
It makes business sense for them, totally.
Yeah, because they're talking about rural areas where one delivery driver maybe isn't making other deliveries on that street. Mm-hmm. And they have to pay for the gas and the truck and the driver.
How big of a market is that?
Also, even in urban areas, you know, in major metropolitan areas where a UPS truck going 20 miles will take 2 hours, you know, delivering. If Amazon buys out the top of a skyscraper or a certain, like a
skyscraper. Do you think that there's any chance we'll see this in a city? I just figured it was going to be out in farmland.
I think eventually companies like Amazon are going to want to operate in cities.
So a lot of power cables and a lot more obstacles.
I just can't imagine legislatively passing easily in a city.
Yeah.
What do you think will get us there? Is it confidence in battery technology, confidence in, you know, speed controllers, more standardization in, you know, how these things are built?
Years of proven, you know, reliability in more rural areas.
I think it's going to take what Uber did, which is basically breaking the rules a little bit until the customer base was so fanatical about it.
That's right.
That it put so much pressure on the governmental agencies to make it work.
And you know, maybe it's not right over the city. Maybe it becomes airspace, not just altitude wise, but airspace around air lanes around the city, which makes a lot of sense. You know, you buy a factory by the harbor, you know, by the peninsula, and then that it takes off, goes over the water. where it doesn't matter if it falls, you lose the drone and the item, but then it can get south of the city or it's close enough to another delivery place, right?
They're going to find a test market for it.
I want to see this happen. I know.
Dude, if I could get a drone delivery today from Amazon, I would absolutely sign up for that just to see it happen.
It's going to be clunky to start, and we all want to get to the eventual point where it's seamless and it's day to day. And the infrastructure is like airplane infrastructure now, which is like our human brains can't even comprehend the level of complexity that airplane, like the whole airplane industry encompasses. It's so many more planes than you think and so many more routes, but it works seamlessly with all these things built in and with statistically very few incidents.
Thanks to a lot of very alert, attentive air traffic controllers.
That's right. But that's the kind of infrastructure we want to get with autonomous vehicles and autonomous drones in the future. And it's going to be an iterative process. So I want to see the next step, as clunky as that may be, because it will get us hopefully eventually to that. Yeah, I hope it's not waiting for a fictional technology, you know, anti-gravity.
Oh, gosh.
That's not going to be the thing. It's going to be stepping stones along the way.
Yeah.
Super fast Wi-Fi.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this. Do you guys ever use public Wi-Fi, whether it's like a Starbucks or...
Airport,
Does that count?
Airport totally counts.
Yep.
So...
Well, you have to use Wi-Fi if you're on a service like Google's Project Fi.
Yes, which we'll talk about later because I'm on it. San Francisco, where we live, has a public Wi-Fi infrastructure they've built, but it's kind of shoddy and the reviews of it haven't been good. New York just launched gigabit Wi-Fi where they're basically, it's not full gigabit Wi-Fi, but that's what that's what they're calling it.
You're right for the term.
They basically are taking old payphone booths and converting them into USB power stations and public Wi-Fi hubs. And the speed tests for them are ridiculously fast.
Converting old phone booths is delightful.
Oh,
I love that idea.
Do you see I think you have the picture up. It's a beautiful interface that's there where you can basically call for 911. There's like emergency services there. There's a USB power. They look good. They add advertising mechanisms there, so which brings in more revenue. But somebody did a test. Gizmodo went and did a test, got 436 megabits download, 360 upload.
Jeez. Wait, wirelessly?
Wirelessly.
Jeez.
And so they're sort of saying like, if you're Starbucks or any of those like cafes that are using Wi-Fi to bring in people, this is going to be trouble for you. And in New York, they're trying to roll out 7,500 of these in around New York City.
I wonder how over time, if there's like a heat map of how that actually changes not only where people hang out, but where people live. I'm kind of like the Google buses, kind of that actually has social, socioeconomic like effect on on the,
like, where are the good schools, where's the good internet?
Exactly, right? Yeah. Like is it arbitrary? I don't know, probably not arbitrary placement of these locations, but if they're converting existing bathrooms, those are in place already, right? So how does that affect over time?
I think that's a really great question. I just I love that New York City's doing this. I think New York City is really progressive about some of this stuff. I think the pushback from the business sector is going to be high. I think Starbucks is going to start fighting stuff like this. Starbucks and similar places, because they're going to lose business.
How attractive is? I mean, but they're not offering tables and and coffee.
No, but in a dense urban environment like this, you could get this inside your apartment. Like the Gizmodo did a test from the platform at on the F train and got 45 megabits, download.
Right.
So if you're going to be doing it in places that you're just going to be, it might take away a little bit of that need. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I think Starbucks is actually more accepting of it than if New York puts up one of these close to a Starbucks, then you can still enjoy the Starbucks. Enjoy the atmosphere and the table and the power they provide, you know, for a cup of coffee and still take advantage of New York City's Link NYC.
Yeah, they might have to close one Starbucks in New York City. I'm not too concerned about Starbucks. Service ad supported? Or is it fully subsidized by the city?
I think currently it's fully subsidized by the city.
Huh.
And it's through this group called Link NYC.
Mm-hmm.
And
hi, Joey.
It'll be... We're hearing the sausage making in the background. I think it'll be interesting to see how other cities do it, because I don't think other cities will have the infrastructure and means of a New York City. If they try to roll this out, we've seen this during South by Southwest been rolled out during the conference in Austin, shamelessly
and shamelessly. Sometimes really poorly thought out and implemented. I mean,
but the overall concept of it, I mean, putting aside how terribly thought through that was,
and I'm talking about Vagabond Wi-Fi,
yeah,
which is a nice way of putting it,
which is terrible, but the concept of it, I think, is great because it's utilizing public space that has no utility right
now. There's some caveats. When we say 7,500 units, that's over the next 12 years.
Oh, yeah.
When we talk about service area, you know, even though you can get it from the train station, it is only about 400 feet, and distance really matters for the strength of Wi-Fi.
Obama has pushed for internet to be considered a public utility. Like others. It's interesting to me, though, that this indicates, well, and this, you know, other cities have done this too, but this kind of thing indicates that it might be the first free public utility, that it might be the first thing that is just taken for granted by everyone, that is just provided. Unlike, you know, your water supply and your trash pickup.
Right. And I think, you know, the bandwidth may be high, but what I think they should do is probably what airports do with their Wi-Fi, which is the time limited. You know, if you're going to provide this strong Wi-Fi and you don't want people just to huddle around your bathroom,
it'll probably be throttling.
And throttling, or, you know, you have a 30-minute limit. You know, you're supposed to use it to check your email, not sit there and stream on Netflix for 2 hours. And get for short sessions, you need Wi-Fi, and then you're moving along, and then you need the technology also that, like Project Fi, to then seamlessly pass off from Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi network.
I don't know. It seems like, I think Kishore's right. People are going to start receiving this into their homes, and this is just going to become their internet provider that they use all the time.
In dense urban areas.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There are a few new Apple apps out.
And yeah, Jeremy, today, isn't that weird? Why? Why did they release apps? There's no event. There's no announcement today. They released a new version of GarageBand, which now supports their new iPad Pro. I was kind of surprised that didn't come out with the iPad Pro. But so it supports that new high-res screen. It also supports the Force Touch on the new iPhone 6s, 3D Touch. And it has some new stuff, a new drummer feature, so that it will just play drums. And you don't have to orchestrate them, which is kind of interesting. But I thought what was even more interesting was that other app, the iPhone app, the music memos. Did you see that?
Yeah. What is this?
When I saw it, I thought it was a tracking app. There's just a ton of tracking apps in the App Store. I figured, why are they doing that? Where you would lay down one layer of a song, and then you'd lay down another layer and kind of put things together. But it's not that at all. You say you're a guitar player. You play music into the microphone. And it will listen to your song. It will just record it. But then when you hit stop, it will actually identify the breaks in your chords, and it will label the chords with their actual, you know, key. And then it can add a rhythm track to what you just played.
Oh, that's awesome.
Automatically. So it'll just... Oh, that's a phone call.
That's not a rhythm track at all.
And it will play drums and bass underneath what you had just played, and it can, adjust the complexity of that rhythm track. It seems very cool. I mean, it's not something that I've seen in the App Store yet. So, you know, I'm always curious to see why they release apps, because they typically lead the way with productivity apps, and they show. Oh my God, there's so much throwing things today.
It's all coming apart. Sorry, Jeremy.
And so I guess they've done that with music again today, which is kind of interesting. I'm going to be playing with that app myself.
All right, we do have Kishore here, our senior science correspondent. So this week we get a special science minute, for which we still don't have a theme song.
Oh, I bet someone will be happy
to
provide that.
Please, we need a theme song for the science minute. I'm going to give you what's the sound of science?
That is a great question.
It's a Beastie Boys song.
We can't use Beastie Boys songs.
We'll figure it out. We'll figure out a Science Minute. We actually got to come up with a better name than the Science Minute. It's too derivative of other minutes here. But I'm going to do a quick lightning round. Last time I was here, I talked about CRISPR, which is this cut and paste technology to edit DNA that's going to be used in human cell lines. It's going to be used in agricultural technology, you name it. And I mentioned that there was going to be 2016 was probably going to be a tough year because there's going to be a massive patent war between Berkeley and MIT over this. Well, the first volleys of that patent war started yesterday. The patent office is actually already mitigating this fight between two scientists, Jennifer Doudna at UC Berkeley and Feng Zhang at MIT. The head of the institute that Feng Zhang works at MIT is called the Broad Institute. And the head of that is this really famous scientist, Eric Lander, one of the most revered biologists in all of the world. And he put out an article in this journal called Cell called Heroes of CRISPR, which details a history of how it was developed. And people read it and immediately were like, this guy's creating a revisionist history to support the patent filing. And so basically this scientist who's supposed to be revered for being objective, like there is an intense amount of criticism that he's rewriting history for a legal fighting. And it's getting ugly real fast. So I think the technology to cut and paste DNA is going to be a massive, massive explosion of research in this over the coming year. But welcome to patent troll season. And it's unfortunate. And I think you're going to hear a lot more about it. There was some great reporting in Wired this week on the topic for those that really want to know more. But it's going to get ugly. And it's hard to have a dog in the fight. But it's like the tactics are going to be like this.
What are the potential consequences if one, you know, one company gets all the patents?
Like billions of dollars. So basically, like Berkeley filed the patent first. MIT filed the patent second, but fast-tracked the patent. So they were awarded the patent because they paid a higher fee to fast-track the patent. And they already spun off a company to do the profit. So a company like Monsanto that wants to use this technology to breed new plants is going to pay a fee to that company to use the technology. Now that fee is, they are calculating it'll be in billions of dollars over about 10 years. So the fight is over a huge amount of money potentially.
That's even bigger than VR.
We'll get to that.
Will my kids be able to splice their kids together?
It's so early to say what this will be used for, 10, 15 years down the line. I think the hope right now, I think agriculture is going to be the first place it's used. But the real hope down the line is like it's a way to really solve genetic diseases that we have a really strong indication that it's going to cause problems.
At what level in terms of growth and development?
Pretty much anywhere. I think the one that I hear most commonly referred to, there's a couple, but Huntington's disease, which is developed in utero. So I think that's where you're going to probably see it first is on fetal tissue. Mm-hmm. But I think the sky's the limit with this.
Let me one more question. Can I at this point at the point that this becomes real and practical at age, let's say 45, will I be able to use to splice my DNA?
What do you want that you don't have, like a tail or something?
I don't know. Wings would be cool. I've always wanted to be an X-Men.
No, I think I. It's hard to imagine a future 10 years out with what this technology will get. I think there's so much. It's advanced so much in 3 years. The cynic in me says they're probably going to hit some big scientific hurdles. So I would say it's early, but a patent war stops all of that innovation, which is a real problem. Okay, I have two more.
All right.
Three more. Scary one. Lyme disease is on the rise. It's now in half of all U.S. counties. It is the largest vector-borne disease in the country. And we don't have a good way of understanding how to stop the ticks that carry it.
Ticks!
There's 300,000 cases in the U.S. this year, so surpasses any sort of other insect-borne disease like malaria or anything else in terms of U.S. Yeah. Population. And we don't have an effective way to stop it right now.
Or cure it.
No. And just as an aside, they did a first arthropod biome, which is in North Carolina. Researchers painstakingly went through somebody's house and collected all of like the insect specimens they could find in just somebody's house. They found 100,000 different species.
Wow. You know, if a tick burrows, if you go camping and tick burrows into your leg or something, do you know how to get it out?
Match?
That's, yeah, that's not a leech.
A tick. Like if it's
really?
If its head is in you, you don't pull it out.
You light it on fire.
You light a like a small pin or something and prod it, and then it'll climb out. Because if you just yank it out or twist it, you're just gonna tear its head off.
Yeah, that's
inside of you.
Thank you. You learned something on Tested.
Right. So Lyme disease, watch out. Ebola outbreak, WHO, the World Health Organization, declared the Ebola outbreak over.
And then immediately after,
8 hours later, found a new case.
Oh.
So, but we're really close for this Ebola outbreak to be contained. And it's a huge success in terms of how they contained it and how quickly they mobilized a number of units.
Wait, they thought it was over in Africa?
Yes.
Wow.
They had no active cases until 8 hours after the announcement.
Huh.
And they have one active case, and now they're putting containment on it to make sure there's no others.
That's a
that result from it. Yeah, it's a huge success compared to where we were 6 months ago talking about Ebola.
Yeah.
So that's how quick they mobilized. It's incredible. And the last thing, this is going up Thursday. So if you're listening to this really, really early on Thursday, go outside and watch the planetary alignment that's happening with Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, and Saturn all aligned in the night sky right now.
What does it look like? A straight line?
Yeah, pretty close to a straight line.
Awesome.
You have to be somewhere clear. I'm trying. It actually peaks on Wednesday, the day before the day we're airing this. So I'm going to try to get my son out in the middle of the night tonight to try to check it out.
Astronomers and astrologers are freaking out about this. I bet.
I'm not real well connected to the astrology community. There are astronomers that are freaking out about it just because it's so cool. And it's something that you rarely get to see, that kind of alignment.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to Jupiter. I think Jupiter and Saturn aren't the easiest to see at all times in the night sky. So to have them together and to have a night when the moon isn't out to dilute their visibility is great. So that's it for the Science Minute. Go outside and look at the night sky.
Awesome. Thank you, Kishore. And now it's time for to thank our second sponsor for this week's episode of This Is Only a Test, which is Squarespace. You guys know about Squarespace. Their service allows you to make beautiful websites with no coding, because building a website can be tough. And even if you know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. None of us have the time. Whether it's for a business site, a portfolio, a restaurant, or whatever else, in this day and age, you probably need a website anyway. Well, lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Squarespace provides simple, powerful, and beautiful websites that look professionally designed regardless of skill level, no coding required. And not only does Squarespace provide you with intuitive and easy-to-use tools to create your website with, Squarespace also has state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure security and stability. And you know you can trust in Squarespace for your website needs when millions of people and some of the most respected brands in the world trust in them too. Still on the lookout for anyone who could find my old GeoCities website.
Death Dealer?
No.
Then
Frantic.
Death Frantic.
Yes, with DETH. See if you can find it. The website can build with Squarespace today. Infinitely better. Seriously, you can't beat the ease and simplicity of Squarespace. You also have 24/7 online support. And so what are you waiting for? Start a trial with no credit card required. And if you use the offer code TEST, you get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for this podcast. Thank you, Squarespace. And thank you guys for supporting This Is Only a Test. Squarespace, you should. Hey, what time is it, Jeremy?
It's time for the VR Minute.
Virtual reality. this week.
All right, we had an extra long VR meeting last week, but this week there still turns out lots to talk about. I know we're actually running a little short on time. Kishore, you got time for a VR minute update?
Absolutely.
So, Jeremy, this week both you and I were invited to play in the Eve Valkyrie Alpha.
Yes.
Yes.
Is that a proper reaction to the experience in game?
That's what my 5-year-old does every time something cool happens.
Both you and I had played Elite Dangerous with the DK2 for a while, Elite Dangerous will not get I think Oculus support at launch.
Totally different
launch.
Game.
Completely different game. It's a space sim. There is combat in it, and I do love the combat in Elite Dangerous. But the game you told me you really wanted to play was Eve Valkyrie, the space combat dogfighting game.
Yeah,
that we got demos of early, the early builds of before the Unreal Engine, back when they were in Unity at I think GDC 2014.
Mm-hmm. I grew up playing Wing Commander and X-Wing and TIE Fighter, and there haven't been those kind of games in a long time. And I love them, and so combining that with VR is just the perfect 10 for me.
So the alpha available right now to some members of the press and some members of the community gives you, it's a multiplayer game, but does give you basically access to the interface, you know, exactly how the matchmaking works, and they're stress testing their servers. Did you want to talk about the actual gameplay experience, or maybe the interface experience first?
The interface for the game.
Yes,
I thought the interface was spectacular.
Yeah,
I mean, I would be happy making a demo of VR just with that interface.
The interface is a virtual space. Yeah. Now, it sets you not in like astrophysics lab or anything like in Star Trek, but you are an avatar, you know, sitting in a chair and you look around. It's gaze. It's pointing, right. So you're looking around, but you don't have a cursor on the screen. This is something that developers told me was not needed, unlike in Gear VR, where you have a dot, a crosshair where you look. Here, you look at different things, and the animations on the things you look at change depending on to activate.
Or the size of them or what have you. And then the little subtitles might appear beneath saying press A to activate.
Mm-hmm. So you're using a gamepad for this one. I don't think the throttle and joystick support is supported.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. Used to have that. I think they added it recently.
Okay.
Supports the high tech, the sci-tech.
But you can choose your ship, customize your ship, build a squad. The menus are all, you know, it's a very console game-like menu, but again, it is more of a space than a screen.
I will say having a HOTAS does not give you any added control though. It's very rudimentary. It's very accessible.
Yeah. If with a gamepad, because it will launch with the Rift, everyone who pre-ordered it gets this game, and you have an Xbox One controller, Xbox One controller. You fly it just like you would a space shooter. It's, you know, inverted controls or non-inverted controls. You have your shoulder buttons for roles, and it's a multiplayer space 360-degree, six-axis freedom deathmatch game.
So do you feel like it's ready? It'll be ready for launch?
Totally.
Oh, well, it's not done. Like, in the beta, there's a lot that's not there yet. All the single-player stuff, all the training mission, there's a very stripped-down training section, but all of the expanded training stuff is not in there yet. It looks like there might be something there's some sort of small offline mode that's not there, but this is clearly a multiplayer combat game. That part is what's working, and they wanted to beta test that network functionality.
How do you like it?
I do like it. I question whether or not it's going to be like the Quake, the Doom rather, of like a virtual reality, or the Wolfenstein, like the game that is that quintessential game we all look back on as like the first time that we just said, wow, that was
amazing.
It's
hard to imagine the first game that launches.
No, true. And so I'm not saying this is a bad thing. This is a spectacular move by Oculus. So this is the perfect game to release with the Rift because it is a cockpit game, which, as we've discussed many times, is a nice safe way to introduce people to VR without introducing motion sickness because they are in a static environment that doesn't make them feel like they're moving too much unnaturally. But it also really encourages you. The gameplay really, it benefits you to look around, which is something that everybody who steps into VR sort of inches into. People spend a lot of time looking straight forward, like they're looking at a monitor, and they might look around a little bit to get a little bit of context. But this game, like the actual strategy of the game, relies on you following targets with your eyes in order to maintain a lock. So if you're looking all around your cockpit, and I'm thinking there's like a good 9 degrees in every direction that you really need to move your head in order to play the game well, that is going to set this game apart from anything else that people have experienced before. So, and obviously people have been playing this for 6 months or so, and there are some people in the game that are just far and beyond more talented and more, they understand this game better than anyone else who's stepping into it. So there's that level of frustration, you know, if you're wanting to get into this and have a, and just shoot, you know, maybe AIs or something like that, that is a little bit easier and makes, you're not going to feel like a good player yet. But, you know, if you can at least have some patience, learn the strategy, go to the forums, there's a lot of tips. It's going to be a good time.
Did you lose yourself in the game?
I did, and something. One of the things I realized also quickly is that DK2 is sufficient to play this game, but isn't by no means going to be the best experience. I mean, the Rift is going to be the best experience to play this game.
Yeah,
the 75 hertz is okay, but I'm still feeling a little bit of discomfort because it is a fast-moving game. Mm-hmm. And I had played it on the Consumer Rift at the preview event I went to for, you know, at least an hour, and playing in there, I got lost for an hour, no problem.
Yeah,
playing with the DK2, I did have to take breaks between the rounds.
I feel very privileged being able to play on the DK2 so I can get used to that and then really experience the jump for the Rift. It's an excellent game. There's some interesting control issues where they limit sort of what you can do compared to something like Elite Dangerous. There's no strafing at all.
That's right.
I think by design, because if you did allow strafing, you just end up in these constant battles where people are circle strafing each other, and it's sort of just this loop, and there's very little strategy involved in that, as opposed to like who can aim a little more accurately in that circle strafing phase-off.
And not perfect Newtonian physics for starting and stopping.
Right, exactly. Yeah, you can't stop. But besides that, you got to find out how to get behind obstacles in order to avoid the missiles and avoid fire. You want to stay out of the open areas. A lot of interesting little bits of strategy.
It's also a game where audio matters a lot too.
How so?
Just being able to hear and for the immersion.
To deduce where your enemies are?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Can't wait to share more about it. I mean, I just started playing it last night for two rounds. I'm liking it a lot. I'll be playing more tonight. I had to try it with the HOTAS as well. There was a Goldman Sachs report that was released about the market for VR this year. And there's some interesting insights from what they were able to glean, at least in terms of the production costs of the hardware and what they expect to be the market for VR, which they think is about potentially 6 million units this year.
They're saying in 10 years, it's going to outpace TV, that it will be an over $100 billion business by 2026, and TV will be under.
Yeah, that report was really interesting because it was very aggressive in terms of some of its projections from my perspective, but it also laid out what they think the cost of components are in some of these VR.
Yeah, which is suspect because no one has the final hardware.
It does, but it did... Did you see the component cost piece?
Yeah, they said they thought that the Rift cost more than the Vive to make.
About $100 more.
Yeah, and the PSVR would be even cheaper. Where are they getting this information? How are they?
No idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I like I said, I think that's suspect. It might just be hunches right now. We'll wait for the teardowns.
And their one of their conclusions is, you know, them favoring Sony's platform as initial driver of VR, which we've all assumed is right. You know, while Oculus may get in the enthusiast community the most attention and the most PR in terms of how much money, you know, Facebook is putting into it, it really Sony is the dark horse candidate right now. They've only shown at, you know, gaming events, and it's as widespread in terms of public awareness, but there are so many more people with PS4s right now than with the high-end PCs are willing to spend the extra money for specifically for games.
Yep, that's true. But on the other hand, they will be last to market, and by then they'll have more to prove. You know, the bar will have been set by these higher-end devices. So it'll be interesting to see how they compare.
I mean, the Sachs report agreed with you, saying PSVR is probably going to be the leader, though it indicated Gran Turismo as the game that they thought was going to lead the way, which seems a little funny to me.
Cockpit game. I don't know. Maybe.
I mean, Gran Turismo has for a long time been a killer app for PlayStation.
Totally. It's a killer game for them. It just seems a little dated for me right now. But it indicated they think Steam is going to outdo Oculus.
Wow.
In terms of sales?
Yeah, and just market share. Which I'm a little surprised about.
Yeah, me too, given that it's probably going to be more expensive and it's second to market.
Yeah, I think the key is, and I think Will said this last week, was it's probably going to, we need to see iterations in the hardware. When you can get a phone that's going to.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think either Valve or Oculus is going to rate the success of that platform based on this generation.
Yeah.
All right. Next week, there is a Valve VR showcase, speaking of Steam VR and Valve, which they're planning to unveil some of the third-party games that they've been working with that will be out sometime this year. Games and experiences. Things that Valve promises that we haven't seen before. I'm super excited to be for it. I think we will be there to cover it. Some of the developers we know that have showed games before, like Alchemy Labs, Job Simulator, I think they're going to be there as well. But I'm excited for some of the games that we've only seen brief looks at, trailers, and some of the people have only shared like short YouTube demos of. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see those there.
No first party stuff, though.
No first party stuff. There was some confusion when HTC said they were excited for what Valve would unveil at the developer showcase, but it's what Valve is going to unveil on behalf of other developers.
Yes. No,
on behalf of themselves. So
no Half-Life 3.
No Half-Life 3. It's long story short. But a developer that does have the HTC Vive and is thinking about making games, I'm really excited about this, is the one of the co-creator of Rick and Morty, Justin Roiland. I don't know if you guys have seen the show. It's like maybe...
Yeah,
it's like
you mean Rick and Morty?
Show. Rick and Morty.
Yeah, Rick and Morty is great.
I guess I haven't actually seen it, but I know about it. It's Back to the Future themed, right?
To say it's Back to the Future themed, that's just the on the surface premise. Watch two episodes. By the second episode,
don't let your kids watch it, though.
Yeah, it's not a show for children, but it is a sci-fi. It's a really good sci-fi show,
okay.
Comedy,
right.
Animated show. But Justin Roiland, who is the co-creator along with Dan Harmon, has HTC Vive, and he's been sketching up ideas, notebooks full of ideas for VR games. Some of that was shared online. PC Gamer has a report on that. And, I mean, it's pretty neat.
Does he have a relationship with Valve?
I don't know if he has a relationship with Valve.
I saw there's a documentary about Back to the Future, and he was interviewed in it, I think. And he has a lot of Portal stuff in his apartment.
Oh, maybe it's just what he likes.
Yeah.
Interesting. But some of the things he's interested in and things that I actually, between you and Jeremy, talked about was how do you interact with NPCs in VR?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I brought to you the idea a while ago, could you do voice recognition, speech recognition to communicate with NPCs, maybe just in adventure game style, where you read out the first sentence out loud of three choices, like Monkey Island style, but have the NPC react to that. Like, could that work? And I think that's level of immersion that we haven't seen before in VR that I would like to see. Yeah, I don't need to be perfect parsing. It doesn't need to be Siri, but you know, even if I had three choices as opposed to gazing or using a controller to choose those, actually saying out loud, how does that change your experience of the game? Or is that too weird and take you out of the experience?
Right.
Yeah.
Could it get to the point where there's not even choices, where you could just speak a response and it would interpret?
Right, you're just
which branch that applies to.
You're just going to say the first word of a response.
I'm more excited because it represents that kind of comedic talent coming through means the writing will be good in VR in the future, which is the thing I worry about, is that there's probably such a rush to market from developers they're not thinking through the actual game stories.
Come on, man. It takes years of just tech demo awesomeness before we get to good writing in games, right?
It's true, but I mean, this is the forerunner of that, right?
Yeah. That's true.
All right. I think we just have time for a brief what we've been testing. So I'm going to play the music, and Kishore, I'm going to let you lead this because you've been testing a few interesting things.
No, this is
testing.
My...
Wait, we got to play the music. Testing this week.
I forgot about this. It's very modern.
Hey, what have you guys been testing?
This is my Nexus 6P.
Ooh.
Which I got over the holidays. I love it. It's my first phone with a fingerprint sensor. And the fingerprint sensor, just a quick take. Ryan did a great write-up on the 6P on the tested site. You should read it. What I love about the fingerprint sensor is it does the same thing that the 6 Plus does. You map your fingerprint, but it learns over time, too. So every time you lock it, it's creating a more complete picture of your fingerprint.
You know, Apple does that as well, but I found that it actually works against it. It tries
really?
To be too smart over time to a point where it loses.
It's getting better. There's some complaints about, you know, from a blogger that got a cut on his finger and it stopped working as well. But I think that's an outlier.
Does it work with wet fingers?
So Wet Fingers is the only place I've had that it doesn't work great. And it's not because it doesn't recognize my finger. It just thinks there's multiple finger presses.
Fascinating.
That seem to be happening at the same time. I love this phone so far, but the it's my favorite phone since the Nexus 5. But my favorite piece about it is I switched to Project 5.
Yeah, this
which
is
Google's provider service, which combines bandwidth on T-Mobile's and Sprint's network. But more importantly, it's a pay-as-you-go sort of service, meaning you only pay for the data that you use. So I normally use like somewhere around like 2 gigs a month in mm-hmm. data. And I'm on like essentially I used to be on a $50 plan. On Project Fi, you pay a $20 base rate just for like phone and text service or whatever it is. And then you pay $10 per gigabyte that you use. And then you get a credit for any stuff that you're under. So if I use 1.5 gigs, I only pay $15.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So
is there a family plan?
No, there's no family plan yet. I think it's called Project Fi because it is very much a project. I had a not great experience porting my number over, but once I got through that, it's been great. The real benefit about Project Fi is I'm usually really cautious about using public Wi-Fi networks that you just sort of find. But what Project Fi does, it has proprietary software that finds that, connects through a Google VPN to keep your data secure, and it does it on the fly to minimize your data usage on the fly. So if I look down at my phone as I'm driving, I would say it's like almost half the time I'm driving through the city, it's connected to Wi-Fi for data. And so far I've had Project Fi for 9 days now. I haven't reached 500 megs yet. I'm at like 200 megs. Like I might get to like 1.2 gigs this month on total usage.
And you only pay Google. The fact that it uses T-Mobile and Sprint's Wi-Fi or
they networks. Have a business partnership.
Right. You only pay Google.
Yep.
That's cool.
And you prepay advance for your month and then you get a credit back for your next bill. And they sent me a nice like Lego case. Lego stand to build for to hold my phone as a sign up present. I'm really love the service so far, as long as you live in an area where T-Mobile and Sprint networks work for you. I'll have more detailed thoughts on the phone itself in the future, but if you're into phablets, I really like it. The battery life has been excellent on the phone, which I think has been my sort of key takeaway.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that testing and ongoing testing, which we'll be doing more of on Tested. Thank you guys for joining us this week. We have to cut it a little bit short. We are running off to do a video shoot this afternoon.
Boy, my thing was really good.
What was your thing?
I'm just kidding.
Do you have something?
Do you really have something?
No, I'll talk about next week.
Okay. Well, then you're booked for next week, and we hopefully will see you guys next week too on This Is Only a Test. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting us, and we'll see you next week. This outro is an oldie, but I'm pretty sure it's a goodie.
Hi there. I didn't see you.
Tested.
There's a fine line between topless
under,
and side boob.
Under.
It's just what I had queued up. See you next week.